Hello and welcome to this Friday's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls, where we celebrate life's good times and those moments where you just want the ground to open up under you. And today my guest is our very own Kevin Wilson. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello, Joan.
Hi. As you may know, Kevin presents the Monday magazine show here on Vectus Radio. What you might not know is that he's had a bit of a checkered past. He's been a journalist, public sector PR man, communications consultant, postman, and a glass engraver. Now he's taken it a bit easier, writing and staging and acting in plays, running his own theatre company, working for Age UK, and has just written his first novel, Every Reason. Originally from Manchester, he lives here and loves the island. So it's lovely to see you on the other side of the desk.
Yeah, it feels a bit odd, Joan.
Does
but
it?
Yeah, I'll settle in. I'll be fine.
You're in good hands.
Yeah. Okay. I believe you.
Not technically necessarily, but we're going to give this a go. Okay. No, it's fantastic. So thank you for coming in, and people hear you on a Monday, and it would just be really lovely to find out about all the other sides and what you do. And I mean, you're a powerhouse of talent, and your feet never touch. Does your wife ever see you?
don't go there, Joan.
Is she listening?
Yeah, probably not. No, I dropped her off on the red jet before I came in.
That's so wise.
Yeah, that tells you everything you need to know. She doesn't want to hear this. I'm busy, and I've always loved being busy. Whatever I've done, whether I've been in paid work or more recently setting up on my own. Mm-hmm. But I can't, there's something about me, I can't really keep still. I don't know whether it's just a restless thing or what it is, but at the moment it just feels like the creative side is on overload, and I find the words are just coming quite easily. Not learning lines doesn't come easily, but writing them is coming quite easily to me. So plays and books and short stories. So I'm just going with the flow at the moment and really enjoying doing it.
That's fantastic. That's brilliant. Do you have, I know if you're creative, you have all those different sides to you, the writing and the performing. Is there one particularly that you prefer over the other, or you're more at home in?
Well, I feel a lot more comfortable now with writing plays. I've got a bit more of a track record of doing that, and that started about 8 years ago, soon after I came to the Isle of Wight, because I, like so many people, because I had a little bit more time. I wasn't working full-time as a consultant, and I was actively seeking to get involved on the Isle of Wight, so I just joined the Apollo Theatre in Newport, as you do, and went along to a rehearsed reading thing and thought, oh, that'd be fun, because if I can get involved, I can learn how plays sound, and it will make me a better writer. But, of course, the usual thing happens. I'm a man, I've got a pulse, and I can learn lines, and within minutes I'd been sort of signed up to act in plays at the Apollo.
Oh, brilliant.
But so I just went with it. I absolutely loved it. It was just like being in a sweet shop, playing all these parts. It's like being a child again, really, if you're honest. You get to dress up.
Let's pretend.
Yeah, dress up, be someone else.
So who was your favourite character to date that you've been?
My very first one was, I'll never forget this, and one day maybe I'll do the play properly for real. It was a rehearsed reading on stage, first time I've ever been on stage as an adult. I might tell you about my school play experiences another time, but as an adult it's the first time I've been on stage. So I had the script in front of me, but I was playing the part of Donald Crowhurst, who is a bit of a legend in sailing circles, because he was on a round-the-world race and was discovered to be cheating. So he wasn't actually sailing the distance. And it's about his story, or almost entirely about him being on his boat, having these anxious moments and crises of conscience, and then diving off into his memory. So suddenly he's back at school, or he's talking to his wife, and you gradually build up a picture as to why he went through that and the agonies he suffered. And I absolutely loved that, that play.
It sounds very deep.
It was quite stressful and demanding, but I've never touched it since, but I've always had it in the back of my mind that I'd quite like to do that play one day, properly, without the script in front of me. The second one I did, I played in The Crucible, which is a legendary Arthur Miller play. I played Giles Corey, who dies for his conscience. So the joke is that my very first part, I died on stage.
But that's another very... That's heavy going. I did that for my O-level.
Oh, yeah.
And remember that. But you strike me, you've got a natural sense of humour and a natural wit. So have you done in many comedy parts?
Yeah, I've done a few. I've done a few Alan Ayckbourn plays, acting in them. I like him. I like his early plays, because I think they are genuinely funny. But I think just lately he's got a bit darker and deeper, and, you know, I don't like his later stuff so much. But I've played a geeky teacher, dressed mainly in a dressing gown and a bob hat indoors, wearing ridiculous glasses, much like I am now. For the benefit of those not watching in colour.
But I have to just say, he is not wearing a dressing gown or a bob hat. Whatever a bob hat is, he's not wearing one.
All right, a beanie with a bobble on the top. Yeah. So I've played those. I played in several comedies at Bembridge, which I love the stage there. Very silly parts, including a doctor who likes dressing up in women's clothes. Obviously, I'm acting. What else?
Have you ever performed anything you've written yourself?
Yes, yeah. In fact, I was in a play called Wake, which was on at Key Arts last Saturday. Went down really well. There's a cast of about nine, and one of the guys couldn't do that particular performance, so I had to be in my own play that time.
And how did that feel?
Feels good, actually. It just proves the point that if you've written the words yourself, you can instantly understand what the characters are about.
Well, I should hope so.
Yeah, but you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Because sometimes when you're acting, you're just picking up a script, and it's really hard. Yeah. It takes time to actually get behind the words to get a sense of what the writer's trying to get at.
I was just being facetious.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you obviously didn't forget your lines, did you,
no,
Kevin?
No, of course not.
That would have been dreadful, wouldn't it?
I'm a bit of a legend at it. I think I'm driven by fear, because I will spend, I don't know, say 45 minutes a day. If I know I'm going to be into something, I will set aside that amount of time, and I'll sit there like a school SWAT and just read a page and then cover the page over and keep moving my hand down to try and make sure. And only when I've done that one page will I move on to the next one. So I'm usually okay.
Does your wife run your lines with you?
Occasionally, but I know she's not listening, so I can say this. I actually prefer just to do it on my own, to be honest with you. Some people love to record the whole play with gaps for where their part is, and they sit in the car and they're sort of waiting for these gaps to say these lines. I can't do that. I just sit there like I'm at school and learn it parrot fashion.
Yes.
And repetition is everything.
That's how we were taught, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what comes naturally to us.
Yeah,
it's still hard work, isn't it?
It is.
And you, like you say, you've just got to put the time in, haven't you?
Yeah. The funny thing is, you can spend all that time on it, and I've been backstage before now. In fact, I can remember it. There was one play where it was just the two of us for almost 2 hours, so I was hardly ever off the stage. So it's we've done it several times successfully with no hitches. And we're standing there really relaxed at the start of the next performance. And then we both just looked at each other and said, I can't remember my opening line at all. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Your mind just goes.
Horror. Yes.
Couldn't remember it, neither of us. So we had to immediately run up to the dressing room to get the script and say, oh, yeah, that's it, we're fine now. And then we just sailed through it after that.
Good. But that awful rush of adrenaline
Yeah.
makes you feel so ill.
Yeah. And people talk about stage fright and stuff. I always get nervous before, but I don't know whether it's nerves or is it just the rush of adrenaline. Mm. I'm not sure which it is, but either way, it's pretty tiring. But the other side of the coin is there's not a feeling really quite like it when you've done it and you're getting the applause. It's all these cliches coming out there. But when you get the applause at the end and you get the feedback from the audience, it's an amazing thing to do.
It's so a real rush, isn't it?
Yeah, I really enjoy it. Mm.
And it's all worthwhile, those hours doing the lines. And the rehearsing, it's all worth it.
Yeah.
I did a show a couple of weeks ago at the Earl Mountbatten Hospice with Donna Jones and Gilly Willis, and it was a sort of fundraising evening of comedy.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
Yeah, and we got to the second act, and I did my piece, and Gilly was coming on to close the show, and as I came off I suddenly got taken by this dreadful coughing fit, and I had my water there, so I sort of tried to do that and some apple juice, and then I ran out of the water and I ran out of the apple juice, but I was still coughing, and I was sort of sitting on the stage at the back with Donna, and I thought, what am I going to do? Because I couldn't go across the stage because Gilly was in full flow. I couldn't disappear into the audience because that would have been wrong. So I thought, well, I'll bob round behind the sofa and see if I can open the French windows onto the garden. Well, of course, they were locked.
Right.
So I was sort of lying down behind the sofa with Donna going, "You're right, Chuck." And I'm, no, coughing into my handbag to try and deafen the noise.
Oh, no.
It was just awful. And I found somebody's old bottle of orange juice down there, so I necked that. But it didn't do any good at all. And it's just hideous way to end it. But nobody noticed because I guess the sofa deadened it. But it was just awful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you always feel like you're in the spotlight, don't you? Completely.
Yeah, even when you're hiding behind the sofa.
Yeah, you do. But it's funny, isn't it? We get so self-conscious about it, and you like that on the stage. And I think it's only with years and years of practice that you realise that you just got to be yourself, haven't you? I think.
Oh yes. And I think if you're nervous, that conveys to the audience, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then they're unsettled because they think, I'm not sure if I'm enjoying this, because they then become nervous for you, don't they?
Yeah.
So you think, try not to pass that on.
Yeah, and all the advice is that it's well worth doing all these relaxation exercises before you do something. You know, drop your shoulders. I'm doing it now. My shoulders are up around my ears because I'm a bit tense doing this. So I'm consciously dropping my shoulders now. Breathe properly and you instantly feel a lot more in control and relaxed, and you come across more naturally than if you're hunched over the microphone and stressed. You can see the lines on your face.
Yes.
If you can just force yourself to relax, you're just a lot better.
Yes, often easier said than done, though, isn't it?
I know.
But you're, like I say, your natural sort of gift for comedy. When we were speaking about coming on the show, and I spoke, I think it was a really wet, miserable Monday morning, and I hadn't had the greatest start to the week, and we had a quick chat, and you just made me laugh, you know, and I thought, well, if he can do that, that is a talent in itself.
Good.
And you were telling me that you had been promoted beyond your ability as a journalist, which I just think is the most lovely phrase.
I know.
And I can't imagine it was true for 1 minute.
Oh, it is.
But I like your self-deprecating humour.
Thank you. But if you want me to elaborate on that a little bit, I think that's been the story. One of the interesting things I feel about me is that I've always known when it's been time to move on. I don't need anybody to tell me to shut up or go away or do something different.
Yeah.
So in the world of work, I'm quite sort of strict with myself. I believe in doing it well, being totally committed to something, whatever it is, but then knowing if I'm sort of dipping below those standards or I'm out of my depth. I'm quite honest with myself actually about that. Obviously it's easier now because I've got a few more miles under the clock than I had when I was younger, but it's thinking about coming to chat to you made me realize that there's been a little pattern there, I think, where I've like with the newspaper journalism, I did that straight from school, 1 year college course to learn how to do shorthand and typing, and I can still remember the keyboard exercises where the teacher was watching the way we were holding our hands and fingers, which was so much fun. And I went straight into a job in Stockport in the Northwest and did that, steadily just got promoted. I ended up working for an evening paper in Bolton. I love Bolton. Hello to any Bolton listeners.
It's actually called I Love Bolton, the paper.
No. Oh. No, that's just me.
That would have been a better name for it,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Yeah, we'll change it. It was the Bolton Evening News. But yeah, I lived and worked up there and then moved to the Midlands and became a news editor and then a deputy editor. And I was within an ace of becoming an editor.
Ooh.
Ooh. But I realised at the last minute and just in time that I was hating it, really,
yeah.
Because all my days were spent doing meetings and looking at figures and staff management and stuff. And I thought, that's not what I'm good at.
You set out to write.
Yeah.
And you were put into that kind of management role, which is so often the way, isn't it?
Yeah. So I just realised that I didn't want to take that final step, which would have been the natural thing for anybody to do, really.
Mm.
Would have looked good on my CV for the future, but no, I sort of rejected that idea. And I went on to open a gift shop and became a part-time postman to make ends meet and taught myself to engrave glassware, which was a fantastic thing to do and also made me a lot of extra money from commissions. So
yes.
So I managed to make a go of that over about 3 years.
You're very resourceful, aren't you? Bit of a Renaissance man.
Yeah, maybe. But yeah, I think so. But I think it goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. I feel like I like to dedicate myself to something. So whatever situation I'm in, I've always got the feeling, I'm optimistic, I suppose, I've always got the feeling that I'll be able to make a go of it. And
would you say you're a perfectionist, Kevin?
No, I'm not sure I'm a perfectionist. I don't know how you define it, actually, but I'm driven to always do my best. Whether that makes me a perfectionist, I don't know. But I'm also honest enough to know when my best isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm. That's a skill a lot of people could do with having, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It's a difficult one. I think more of that. I sort of know when it's time to move on. I know when I'm not doing it well, and I rely on my instincts to tell me that maybe this isn't the right thing for me to be doing.
Mm.
So then I'm happy to move on and look for other things.
Could you also, I mean, I know you were a journalist at the time, but you were also a photographer, because you took, when we first met years ago when I moved to the island, you took my photo for a piece in the Chamber of Commerce, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I used to work for the Chamber of Commerce, the Island Business Magazine. I remember interviewing you. It was a lot easier interviewing you. Can we swap?
I remember when you came, and goodness knows I was having a particularly bad hair day, but you were polite enough not to comment. Sadly, though, you did have to take this photo. It's knocking around somewhere, and I've got, like, it looks like I've got a poodle perm, but I just sort of done this 80s scrunch. Goodness knows why, because it was only 7 years ago. The 80s had long gone, and I look absolutely hideous.
I remember you didn't like my photo.
No. Well, it wasn't your photo. It was my poodle perm look. I looked distressed.
Yeah. But I loved taking the photos, apart from that one, obviously. So I loved that time at the Island Business Magazine. So I was editing the magazine, which is a posh way of saying I wrote all the articles and took all the pictures. I loved it. And one of the great things about that was, again, it helped things fall into place for me on the Isle of Wight, because until I took that job on, I'd been more, although I was based here, I was more of a visitor, because I was always working away and then coming back for weekends, you know, during my consultancy days. And I was just getting really tired of it. So I really wanted to do something on the Isle of Wight, and I was so pleased to get that job. But it made me get out and meet people like you and so many other people with amazing stories to tell. And we'll have to turn the tables one day, and I'll have to interview you because you've got an amazing story to tell. But that's the thing, and I am a journalist, I suppose, at heart still, and I love finding out about people and what they do, and it helped me to settle in on the Isle of Wight as well.
Yes, it must have been a good introduction.
There are people I know now, I've got that nice feeling, usually nice, walking around Newport and thinking, I know that person, but only occasionally will I cross to the other side of the road when I recognise someone.
To talk to them or to avoid them.
Yeah. But yeah, so that was a great job for me, and another example of, I knew it was time to stop being the consultant and, stop earning so much money and spend a bit more time having a quality of life. It feels good now to have made that step. I'm a lot poorer financially, but here's another cliche coming, a lot richer as a person.
Indeed, and we're a lot richer for you being here. Talking of the quality of life, I think we mentioned earlier, I mean, it was such a gorgeous day yesterday, it was cold but sunny.
Yeah.
And the baby lambs, we've got so many over in the West Wight, and they've been very sleepy up until now. And yesterday, because the sun came out, there was three very naughty ones playing, and their mums kind of came over and told them to kind of, behave themselves. And then they went running off, and one of them clicked his heels, manner of Dick Van Dyke, which absolutely made my day. All it takes.
Yeah.
I mean, just how lovely is that?
A lamb clicking its heels.
Yes.
I'm not going to ask you what you had for your dinner that night.
No, don't you dare. So what I'd love to hear some of your work, Kevin.
Okay.
Before we break for the ads. So yeah. What would you treat us to first?
Well, I've got one or two bits and pieces, but I thought, just for a change of tone, I might give you the prologue of my crime book. First time I've ever written a crime novel, and it's called Every Reason, and it's available on Kindle. It's the story of a murder and how a woman detective chief inspector solves the crime with a lot of help from a newspaper editor, amongst others. But this first bit just sets the scene. It describes the death, if you like, which leads into the main story. So shall I read you that bit?
We'd love to hear it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So yeah, it's Every Reason, the prologue. Fiona Worsley shivered. She fastened the top button of her red coat, wrapping the silk scarf loosely around her neck, as if it would make any real difference. It had been a long day, but the adrenaline was still flowing. Tomorrow was going to be even longer, leading up to what she fully expected to be one of the biggest nights of her life. It was time to stand up to them. Her heels tapped and the sound echoed as she walked quickly but carefully along the broken flagstones. The only light came from a street lamp on the corner and the occasional glow of living room lamps softened by poor thin curtains. Part of her couldn't really blame the developers, but she was damned if she was going to let them do it without a fight. Her car was just round the corner, and she stopped to open her handbag, fumbling for the keys in the semi-darkness. She moved a little closer to the street lamp and cursed as her scarf loosened in a sudden gust, then unravelled and floated off her shoulders with a whisper. The voice behind her was loud. "Hello." "Oh, it's you," she said, turning. "Sorry, your scarf went that way." "Thank you so much," said Fiona. "My best one too. Didn't think I'd see you again so soon. You should be back home in the warm." Fiona could see the sky blue gleam of her scarf a few yards away, and she tiptoed gingerly through the rubble to retrieve it. "All right now?" "Yes, thanks. Got it." Fiona turned, but there was no time for her smile to become a scream. It felt like her head was being crushed by an enormous weight. There was no pain, just nothing. The houses and the debris, the sky and the dim light seemed to blur into one. There was another thud somewhere in her head, and she fell. Now she was on the ground, drooling, staring through water. And then a great cave of darkness opened up.
Ooh, thank you for that. You have made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, and I've gone all shivery.
Ooh. Ooh. Sorry.
Now I'm already thinking, who done it?
Yeah.
Who is this killer?
Yeah, I liked the idea of starting with that and then letting the story unfold.
Mm, and so she knows the killer.
Yeah, mm. Yeah, yeah. Mm. So there are clues already, aren't there?
Yeah, so it's often the way that
it sort of sets the story, doesn't it? But doesn't give too much away.
I like it.
But such a challenge to do it. I mean, you're a writer, you've written books. This is my first one, so I was so nervous about letting it out into the public realm. Did you have that feeling when you did
your first one? Yes, because you think once you've done it, it's the genie's out of the bottle, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can't get it back.
I know.
And if people say lovely things, that's wonderful. If they say, you know, because your fear is they're not going to like it. So,
yeah.
But there's nothing you can do about it.
I know.
You've just got to trust.
I know. Me. It's a bit like walking into a pub you've never been into before, isn't it? And everybody looks at you and you're thinking, oh.
Well, I think before the internet, I mean, obviously I know, you know, once you publish a book, it's out there, but you could sort of control things more, couldn't you? And think, well, I'll just show this person, I'll just,
yeah.
You know. And it was tighter, but now it's gone, it's in the ether, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's...
I showed one or two people before I did it, but I don't know how much time we've got before you break, but the other thing about me is that I'm very sociable and stuff, but at heart I'm not really. I like working in isolation.
Mm.
So my benchmark for the book was, am I now happy with it? And after lots and lots of soul searching, I decided I was, and then I decided I'm not going to be nervous anymore. I'm going to do it because I think it's okay. And I had that inner confidence that it was okay.
Brilliant. And have you had some great feedback?
Yeah, I have. I've had some excellent feedback. Just need to sell a few more copies now.
Oh, I'm sure you will. Yeah. Okay, well, more of this. We'll hear more of Kevin's work after the break. Thank you.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
This is Vectis Radio.
For the people, by the people.
The Castle St Helens. Superb self-catering accommodation in St Helens, open all year, just a short walk from the beach. Full details, including availability and offers, can be found on our website at www.sthelenscastle.co.uk. It's also the perfect place to book if you have relatives coming to visit you on the island, with special rates available for bookings made from Isle of Wight addresses. Contact us on www.sthelenscastle.co.uk or on 01983 875 993, that's 875 993, to book your perfect getaway on the Isle of Wight. Also see the Facebook page for the castle for more details.
Andy Gustar is here to tell us about Bring a Friend at Hamilton's Fine Foods.
Bring a Friend is a scheme we're running for our existing customers to take away a voucher and to bring a friend in with that voucher next time, so that you each receive a pack of our famous ham, our traditional ham and local ham. We're going to keep this going hopefully for around about 2.5 to 3 months. When you turn up, initially you'll be given a voucher, and on that voucher you'll find there's a small form to fill out as regards to your details, your name, your telephone number or your email address. We want to build a database that we can keep you in contact with our ongoing offers. We do some spectacular offers of a very good quality meat.
Hamilton's are in Newport, they're in Pyle Street. Where else are you?
We're in Cowes High Street, Wootton Bridge. We also have a shop now up on Dodner Industrial Estate.
Hamilton's Fine Foods, the best local butcher in town.
Yeah, just drop me there, Dave.
This is Ted. Ted loves listening to Vectis Radio when he's out and about. Don't you, Ted?
I do. I love listening to Vectis Radio when I'm out and about. I gotta tell you, lugging this desktop PC around is doing my back in.
Oh, Ted, you are silly. If you, like Ted, are finding it troublesome listening to your favourite local station when on the go, here's a simple solution. Just download the Vectis Radio app for free on your smartphone or tablet. Then you can listen to all your favourite radio shows without the inevitable need for a hernia operation.
The Vectis Radio app? On my phone? Sure, I feel like such an idiot.
Oh, you are, Ted. You really are. The Vectis Radio app is in association with Southern Vectis and Red Funnel Ferries, our sponsors on land and sea, helping you listen to Vectis Radio absolutely free.
BrecBuzz presents the local music show.
3 hours of local music
from 7 till 10 p.m.
every Sunday.
Stay social and get in touch.
Give us a call on 01983 240 666
or add us on Skype. It's vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest today, our very own Kevin Wilson. Welcome back.
Thanks, Joan.
So you've written this thriller, which is called Every Reason. Why that title?
Who had every reason to kill is okay. the thinking behind that one. I set the book in an area of the world I know quite well, up north in Manchester, which is where I'm from. I was born and raised in a suburb of Manchester called Stalybridge, and the fictional setting for my book is called Ashbridge. So there's a bit of a clue. So it's all about not just the murder, but the setting is important because it's based around a development that is pretty controversial, because it means knocking down communities of terraced houses and the effect that has on people. So the constant theme of the book really is everything's changing, and everybody's got a vested interest in that change, and it's how they play with each other, as well as the death of a local politician who was violently opposed to the development in the first place.
Right, okay. Yeah. So there's lots of, you know, even if we're not from Manchester, there's lots of common themes that everybody can relate to, isn't there?
Yeah.
And lots of people love a whodunit, don't they?
Yeah, and it's the march of progress, but it's also a simple who did it.
Yeah.
And so I've loved sort of going back to the roots of it and trying to plant false trails here and there to make people wonder, could it have been him or her? And the feedback I've had so far has been really good, that people didn't work out who'd done it.
That's what
so,
you want.
So far, I've had some success.
Excellent.
A surprise ending.
Every bit of feedback I've had, nobody's guessed the ending. And one lovely lady came up to me in Newport and she said to me, oh, my mum sat up all night and read your book. And I thought, my goodness me, you're my age. How old's your poor mother? You know, she sat up all night. It's terrifying, the end of the book, you know, but
yeah,
she didn't get it either. So, you know, that's good when they don't guess who done it.
Yeah, I know.
Fantastic. So I imagine your killer must, so were you in that person's head, in his the psyche, the finding out what made them tick and their motivation?
Yeah, I spent a fair bit of time deciding who it should be as well, quite early on, because mm-hmm. Obviously you want it to be a surprise, but also it's got to stand up. You can't just do a, I don't know what do they call them, a Midsummer Murders plot where, yes, oh, suddenly comes in on the last page and said, oh, it was him.
Well, I have to say, even Broadchurch, for me, I mean, I don't know what people listening think, but having watched that whole series and then the end, it was someone that you just thought, really? You know, you've just suddenly done that. There was no rhyme or reason to it, for my mind. But,
So I like what, the thing about it that I was pleased with was that the person who did commit the murder had did have every reason. It's just that those reasons weren't immediately obvious to everyone, so they took a little bit of digging out. But I loved that. So, you know, again, and that's the title of the book for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Reasons to kill someone. They've got to be pretty strong motives. And there were a lot of people who had strong motives to stop her opposing the development. But not just the development, she had a private life as well.
Yes, they do.
And so there's that element to it as well. So who was she seeing, having an affair with someone? All that
life
comes into play as well.
Tapestry,
yeah. Oh, yes, it's all there.
So did it take you personally into a dark place that you found when your writing day was over, you found it quite difficult to turn off?
No, it didn't, to be honest with you. I think doing the newspaper journalism has made a big difference to me in the way I approach stuff. Because when you're a newspaper journalist, you learn to be detached.
Of course.
You have to be. I cover some horrible, horrible stories, tragedies, children dying in fires and having to go and interview the parents, old people, abuse, elderly people, all that sort of stuff. And you have to switch off and do your job, hard as it is. Obviously, newspaper reporters aren't the most popular people in the world, but I tried to do it with a little bit of respect for the people I was interviewing. But that shows you the importance of just keeping a clear head.
Yeah.
And I used that with the book, really. I was quite journalistic in my approach to it. I wanted to tell the story in a reasonably ordered way that people wouldn't find too difficult to follow. So I've read some books where you just think, I'm completely dizzy now.
Yes.
It's flying all over the place and I don't know where I am anymore. And I've tried to sort of not make it too wide a sweep of characters or of events so that it's relatively easy to follow.
Nice and tight.
Yeah, yeah, hope
keep
so.
Keep with it, yeah.
Hope so.
No, it sounds fantastic. So where can people get this?
At the moment, just by going on to the Kindle store.
Right.
It's every reason. It's only a couple of quid. So that's not a big price
that's
to pay.
That's a small price to pay for all those hours at the keyboard.
Yeah.
No, brilliant. And it's a great bank holiday read by the sounds
of it. Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Yeah.
It's about, I don't know, 300 pages, something like that. So, a day or a couple of days.
Yes.
Job done.
Sorted. Lovely. Brilliant.
Sorted.
So, I mean, then that's your first novel. Are you working on a second one?
Yep, I'm going to. In fact, I've written out the story, if you like, storyline for Every Reason 2.
Uh-huh.
Did you see what I did there?
Reason
2.
Oh, now come on, is that the number 2 or T-O?
Well, yeah,
or?
Well, all will be revealed.
Okay,
I haven't
okay.
got a clue, basically.
It's still a mystery.
It's just number 2, but it sounds all right,
yeah.
Doesn't it? So I'm developing the characters that you will meet in Every Reason 1.
Okay.
Not all of them are going to be in the sequel, but it's going to be another a murder investigation with some familiar characters who are going to be in slightly different situations. It's going to be a completely new story.
Right.
It's not like a continuation where we left off. But I'm really keen. I'm liking the characters that I've created, and I want their stories to develop.
Brilliant.
So I don't just want to do a murder story, as you can tell. I want to do something that people will feel, well, I want to go there. I quite like these people, or I'm interested in knowing what happens to them. And I'm getting quite close to a few of them now. So.
That's the trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you do bond with them.
Yeah.
Even the bad boys,
yeah.
I land up having a bit of an affinity with.
Yeah, and I feel really sorry for one of my characters, whose name is Dorothy. And I've got a little extract if you want me to.
Yeah.
Can I talk about Dorothy for a
Please.
Minute?
Please. Yeah. Okay. And she's from your book.
Yeah. Yeah, she's from my book. But she's real, Joan.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm not making her up.
She's here with us now.
Dorothy, come on down. So Dorothy lives in a terraced house in Ashbridge, an area which is zoned for redevelopment. And she lives on her own because her husband's died. And this is when we meet her, soon after the murder has taken place. Next morning, the sun seemed reluctant to show its face, but at least it made the effort. Walking was a big effort for Dorothy now, but she forced herself out of the house most days to inch along the battlefield of broken flags they called a pavement. It felt good to be outside, and she always looked forward to a chat with Mr. Ola Renshaw, who'd had the corner shop for donkey's years. Dorothy pushed slowly along, the wheels of her tartan shopping trolley drumming and occasionally catching in the cracks. The street of red brick houses had been home since the day she was married, 56 years ago. It was a beautiful June day, and she could still remember Joe's serious face as she lifted the veil and said, "I do." It was like a photograph imprinted in her brain. There was no honeymoon, though they did get to London, no, for a week later that year. Four children grown up and earning money. They usually came to see her at Christmas, but they always seemed so busy. Dorothy stopped for a moment to catch her breath and stretch her back. Across the road, the terrace came to a sudden stop. A whole block had been sliced off. Dorothy and Joe used to have tea with friends in one of those houses. Now it was all dusty rubble, slabs of plaster, and stray ribbons of patterned wallpaper flapping for attention. Poor Dorothy.
Yeah, poor Dorothy, because that's how life kind of goes sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when you see those buildings that have been part demolished and you get that glimpse into somebody's previous life.
Yeah.
And like you say, the wallpaper there, yeah, and the old fireplaces.
Yeah.
And they're just hanging there half,
you know. That's what you get on the news, isn't it? When you see that, like an earthquake or a bomb blast or something, and then you see that a wall of a house ripped off, and you just got the rooms in
where
tears.
Somebody lived that their life, and had happy days, sad days, had their children. And you think so now, and that's just how it is now. It's just there.
I love old Dorothy. And I think she might be making a comeback in Every Reason too, actually.
Okay.
I love her so much.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, have we got any reason to suspect Dorothy?
Well, who knows?
What lurks in that tartan shopping trolley?
Oh, yeah. I think I'm leading you down that route, aren't I? Yeah, you're getting there, Joan. You can see where I'm coming from. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. But I think, you know, it's wonderful that you've written plays as well, that's a whole different discipline, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know it's words, I know it's character and emotion.
Yeah.
But it's a different, totally different way of doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like I say, the reason I love it so much is, and can do it, I suppose, up to a certain level, is because I spend a fair bit of time just acting. So I didn't start writing the plays until I'd had a couple of years or so just being on stage and backstage and hearing the words and learning the lines and reading some classic plays like The Crucible and so on. So it's a bit like writing anything, isn't it? You have to read a lot before you feel you can write.
So immerse yourself in the genre. And
but
absolutely.
Playwriting is just amazing thing, because I've reached the point where it's like a total experience now. I can write myself, my process will be, if you like, just one side of A4, because I was taught as a journalist, if you can't tell a story on one side of A4, don't bother.
That's right.
So so that's where I start, and then I'll just break down the paragraphs into scenes, so the paragraphs become scenes. And then the characters come into the scenes and go out, and then I start playing with those scenes, just separate sheets of A4, and gradually the scenes become another sheet of A4 of their own, and then I will start developing each one. But the thing about it is that I've got to the stage now where I'm seeing and hearing voices as I...
No, yeah, I know exactly.
You know what I mean?
I'm there with you.
Don't call the doctor, Joan. It's all right. I'm fine, really. I'm seeing what the action is as I'm writing it. And it's quite a weird thing, actually.
But that's when it comes to life in your mind, isn't it? Which is your mind's eye.
Yeah.
And then when you actually hear the actors say your words and perform, that must be magic.
I know it is. Yeah, especially when they've actually learnt the lines and they're not making them up, which does happen. I've done that.
Yeah,
I didn't write that, did I? Surely not. But yeah, but it is an amazing feeling. And the best bit of all was the very first play I put on was called Sins of the Past, which was about a bit gritty. It was about abuse in an elderly person's home.
Right.
So pretty tough stuff. I gave it a happy ending the first time round, but I since rewrote it, so not quite as happy an ending. But the very first time I sat at the back of the Apollo Theatre where I staged that play, I've never been so terrified in my life.
No,
you know,
I bet.
And the audience coming in and sitting down and waiting for it to start, I just had no clue how they were going to receive it.
And how did they receive it? Oh, fantastic.
We got amazing feedback from it. And the best bit of all, I suppose, that my acid test is if I write a play, I'll get a few actors together to read it with me. If they want to be in it, I'll know it's going to be okay, because they're the best judges.
Of course.
Say, well, I want to be in that play, I'd like that part. And if they start saying that to you, you're pretty sure that it's okay.
Yeah, because they've got to be your best and worst critics,
yeah,
haven't they?
Yeah, because they're the ones who are going to have to stand up there and
do it. Yeah, they're living and dying on that, aren't they, literally?
Yeah.
So have you got anything from the play that you can share with us?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Jo.
I thought it might be.
somewhere on this gadget. Yeah, we mentioned Wake before. It's a play I wrote a year ago to go alongside an art installation at the Depository in Ryde. So it was premiere was at last year's Ryde Arts Festival, but since then we've developed it and we're taking it to Brighton Fringe.
Yes,
next week.
I was going to ask you about that. That's really exciting, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
So how many of you are sailing the Solent to Brighton?
There's 9 of us in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going over in a couple of cars next Saturday.
Wonderful. And how many shows have you got?
We're doing 3 Saturdays, 2 in May and 1 first weekend in June.
Wonderful.
With no idea who will come, if anybody will be there, but that's the fringe. You just don't know if you're going to have an audience or not.
And where's your venue?
Thank you for allowing me to give it this plug. No. It's the Purple Playhouse Theatre in Montefiore Road, Hove.
Right, okay.
And I chose that one because it raises funds for the Grace Eyre Foundation, EYRE, Grace Eyre, which raises funds for people with learning disabilities. So the higher fee for me to put the play on goes to the charity.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So that's why I've done it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, good for you. And best of luck with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful.
We might
need
it, Joan.
No, I think it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, we've had amazing feedback for the play, so we're really excited. And hopefully we'll build an audience up over the 3 Saturdays.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the plan. No. That's the theory.
Excellent.
Okay. Anyway, this is a little monologue from the play called Wake. This is a man who met the star of the show, the heroine, Mel, on a cruise. And he's talking about himself. It's not that long. Okay. I fell for her the minute I saw her on the cruise. It took a lot of courage and even more persistence, but I finally managed to find out her name and where she lived, and got a sort of lukewarm agreement that maybe we would meet up again one day if I was passing. She lived miles away. But with lots of time on my hands these days, I was passing quite often. I'd never really taken much notice of women before, don't know why. Always been rather preoccupied with work, I suppose. Running your own business, it's a hell of a commitment. Cost me a marriage, but I hardly even noticed, because I just threw myself into building the business up. Fast deliveries to fast food outlets. Did very well. Totally motivated, totally committed. Well, you have to be if you're going to make a success of it. And then age started catching up on me, started making the odd mistake, let one or two big customers down. I didn't want to let go, but I gave in eventually. Got a good price, went travelling for a while, cruises mainly. Felt completely lost. My life had been all mapped out. It was only when I stopped that I realised life had actually been passing me by. Meeting Mel made me light up inside. I think I love her. I don't think she knows that. True love. What is that? True love. And you give to me as I give to you. True love, true love, love forever true. Let's face it, it's bollocks, isn't it?
That's great, I love that.
There's a lot more, but I think I'll cut that short.
So, you shouldn't have done. I mean, I didn't know you were a singer as well.
No, I'm not.
Man of so many talents. I like that. I really like that character.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people can relate to various aspects of
him. Yeah. I think that's one of the things about the play and why it's worked so well. Its basic story is Mel, whose father dies. She's the only child. He brought her up on his own, and now she's completely on her own. He had a strong religious faith, and suddenly he's gone, and she's thinking, what was all that about?
Mm.
And she's completely lost, like him, in that monologue. And it's the people she meets all have their own different ways of getting through life. So one's into yoga, another one's into meditation, another one's like hard work. Money, mate, it's all about money, isn't it? So you've got all those things going on, and a few religious people, and it's just how she emerges from all that welter of great advice and people saying this is the way you've got to go. She at the end finds her own way, and we found that it's made lots of people laugh. It's also made people shed a few tears. We've had an absolute, of all the plays I've ever written, I've got to say this has generated the most audience response where it's actually said something to people.
I can see why.
Because it's so personal.
Yes, and I can see there's some people can relate to every, you know, different aspects of it, can't they?
Yeah.
I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, well, no, I'm not the yoga, I'm not the meditation, but there's aspects. And
yeah.
And like you say, people are having to find their own way.
Yeah.
And people are very quick to give unsolicited advice,
they
aren't
are.
They? Which is
they
the
are.
Worst kind of advice.
Yes.
Unsolicited advice, yes. Don't yeah. tell me how to live my life, thank you.
I know.
I'm doing a very good job of messing it up without your help.
Yeah, I don't need any help.
Yeah. So, yes, and how we all kind of get there in the end and find that path that we didn't realise we were looking for,
yeah.
I suppose. I don't know.
But I think we're getting a bit deep, but I think part of it is just...
No, I'm very shallow, Kevin. Don't ever worry about that.
No, part of it is just the process of doing it is good, isn't it?
Yes.
Because, as I say, somebody somewhere has always been through what you're going through. But it doesn't matter, does it?
No.
Because it's you, and you have to find your way yourself.
That's right.
Of dealing with it. Because anything else is just false, isn't it?
Mm.
It doesn't belong to you, really. You have to find your own way.
Wise words, and I think we'll end on those.
Yeah, shall we?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
No. All right, you cut me off now, Joan.
No, I think you've ended on a high there, Kevin.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks,
talking
Joan.
To you. And like I say, very, very best of luck with the Brighton Festival.
Oh, thanks, Joan.
And I'm looking forward next week to talking to Emma Guy. Now, Emma runs the Beach Hut Cafe and Catering in Bembridge, and if you've ever sort of stopped off there for a cup of tea and a scone or a crab salad, she does fantastic food, and she's coming in to talk foodie stuff with me next week, and I can't wait because she's bringing cake. Thank you, Emma. So have a wonderful bank holiday weekend. Enjoy the weather and spot those gambling lambs. And if they don't stop, it's going to become a very bad habit. Okay, bye-bye. See you next week. Bye-bye.